Anchor.fm and clicking on Donate today.
October is Filipino American History Month to honor the moment in history when the first documented Filipinos on a Spanish galleon arrived in Morro Bay, California in October, 428 years ago. Tune in Friday night, October 23rd from 6 p.m. to midnight as KBOO airs music, interviews, and live programming that give voice to largely untold stories of Filipino Americans who have shaped American culture and the course of history. We'll hear from legends such as Joe Bataan and Fanny, as well as hip-hop artists like Bamboo and Rocky Rivera. That's Friday night, October 23rd, starting 6 p.m. to midnight at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good morning. This is Between the Covers on KBOO Radio. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and I'm pleased to welcome to the studio T. Geronimo Johnson, author of Welcome to Braggsville, which is just out in the paperback edition. T. Geronimo Johnson is also the author of Hold It Till It Hurts, which was a finalist for the 2013 Penn Faulkner Fiction Award. Briefly, Welcome to Braggsville is about four UC Berkeley students who stage a dramatic protest during a Civil War reenactment. Geronimo Johnson, thanks very much for coming into KBOO while you're in Portland.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
To tell a little bit more about the plot, Welcome to Braggsville centers on this group of four students at the University of California at Berkeley, particularly one of them, a white kid from Braggsville, Georgia, named Darren Little May Davenport. The others in the group are Lewis, who is Malaysian-American from the Bay Area, Charlie, who is African-American from Chicago, and Candace, who claims to be part Native American from Iowa, I believe.
Yes.
And they give themselves the name the Four Little Indians. They decide to go to Braggsville, Georgia, Darren's hometown, to carry out a performative intervention at the town's Civil War reenactment. Can you talk about how you got the idea for this novel?
I've had the idea for the novel for a number of years, and I tend, though, to work on only one project at a time. So all the while I was working on the first novel, this was bouncing around in the back of my head, and I'd originally conceived of it as a novel with an African-American main character. And then once I started writing, that wasn't quite working, and it was starting to feel too close to the journey that the protagonist went through in my first novel. And so I ended up changing, obviously, Darren's race. And then the story opened up, I think, in ways that made it much more richer than it would have been otherwise for this particular cast of characters, you know.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about Darren, because he's been mocked and bullied in Braggsville. That's a community that's described as producing more special forces soldiers per capita than any other town in America. I get the feeling he's kind of a survivor of a small town, as many of us are. And he's plagued by these feelings of inferiority in the big world of Berkeley. Did you have someone in mind when you switched over to write about this white kid? Did you have role models for him at all that you knew of from the South?
Not at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, no one has asked me that before, and I realized that I didn't have any. So I was really anxious about whether or not I could successfully, you know, craft a novel that captured his world without leading readers to think that I was like too emotionally removed from the subject matter or from the experience. But try to follow this rule of making all of your characters as smart as possible and imbuing them with full emotional life and, you know, human dignity. And so that rule actually helps line by line to guide a lot of the decisions in the plot and in the unveiling of like the story and dialogue and so forth. So no model, but this kind of guiding rule to try to make everyone as best as they could be given the circumstances within which they're living.
We have sympathy for him. He has some real weaknesses that become apparent in the story. I don't know if you want to talk about any of those without giving away too much of the plot.
I would say that, you know, he's maybe a bit like all of us in that it's after we get some distance between ourselves and home or our families or our childhoods that we can sort of adopt a more critical framework for looking at who we were and who we are becoming. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's something that everyone goes through. You know, those first years of college are hugely transformative experiences for so many people. And that, I suppose I didn't need a model for it because that's something that so many of us have experienced firsthand. And then especially if you're from a small town or certain schools, in certain inner city areas, you do show up at colleges wondering if you will make it and if you deserve to be there, mm-hmm. you know, and doubting that you deserve to be there. And I've seen this a lot with the students at Berkeley and other schools.
The group, these four young people, what holds them together?
Well, and they're in some ways a band of outcasts and misfits. And then they're also four people who are equally perplexed by the politically correct culture in which they find themselves and struggling to make sense of how to engage in like really difficult and sticky conversations if you are constantly at a risk of being jettisoned from that conversation if you say like one wrong thing or inadvertently offend anyone. And this is how they meet. They meet at that party where they have all adopted a, we'll say a costume that they hadn't realized would cause so many people to get angry. And that's the situation that finds them together for the first time.
And even before they decide to go to Braggsville, they have at least one other significant action that they conduct.
Right.
Revolves around Ishii.
Yes, right. So they are undertaking what they call a performative intervention, a way of protesting through action, through play, through you know, dramatic performance. And when they learn the story of Ishii, this man who was said to be the last of his tribe lived out his final years in an apartment in a museum, essentially as an exhibit by their minds. When they discover this, they want to honor his memory by symbolically, we could say like re-interring him. But of course, this would be far too complex to carry out with his actual body. So they end up working with books and photographs. But the site that they feel most appropriate is, which was formerly native land, as all the country was, is unfortunately now a amusement park. So they find themselves in Six Flags trying to right this wrong. And
you talked about Berkeley, which is called Berserkly in the book pretty much most of the time. And so you have these two worlds, Braggsville, this small southern town, and Berkeley. Did you want to have those two poles of aspects of culture? What exactly did you hope to do with those two settings?
They're working as kind of emotional bookends. I think that most of us in America are not 100% Berserklyites, nor are we 100% Braggsvillians. We're somewhere on this continuum in the middle. But in order for the story to have the kind of emotional and intellectual space that it needed, it had to encompass these points that might feel like extremes, but are really more so landmarks. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that they seem to be very unique in their own way. But if you think about it, they're not really that unordinary. And they're not really that isolated. So things that start in Berkeley eventually make their way. You know, things that start in California and out here on the West Coast do often make their way into the center of the country and across the flyover states. And then in Braggsville, behind all of the kind of political confusion, there's still these enduring family values that are being examined. And it sort of calls into question, you know, the values of tradition, which in some ways are very, very necessary in order to have any cohesive evolution from culture to culture. I mean, from generation to generation within a culture. But also Darren is finding that maybe the way his parents have lived and his grandparents have lived no longer accord with the world, but they're still in an environment where they can live as they have always lived, but he has to change. But he doesn't realize that until he leaves home. Mm-hmm. But he also knows that he cannot be Berkeley either, has to find him his own way and find his self, really.
I'm speaking with T. Geronimo Johnson. We're talking about his latest book, Welcome to Braggsville. This is Between the Covers. Were there aspects of those two cultures that you definitely wanted your readers to be considering, to be dealing with, the culture of Berkeley and this class that they're in, where they're sort of encouraged to do this action that they decide to do, all take the plane to go to the southern town and do this action? And what were you hoping that your readers kind of questioned about that kind of world?
Yeah, you know, it was definitely a case of wanting to raise questions more than provide answers. You know, I think a novel is much better when it causes you to think instead of telling you what you should think. And so in this instance, there are these two poles that seem to be at odds, Berkeley and Braggsville. But within them, at least in Darren's case, I wanted people to think about what it means to receive ideas from other people about the world that are not your own ideas, and to not question those ideas before going forward. And, you know, the thing is, I think so many of us are, like Darren, trying to find a safe place for our heart. And in the end, you have to put it back in your body and learn to live in your body. And he'd been trying on these different ideologies, but none of them were really quite him. And so that's one idea. And I think that maybe to kind of reframe that, I often describe it as a case where there are cars in my garage that don't belong to me. You know, when you like do meditation or you sort of sit with yourself and observe the thoughts that run through your mind, some of them are arising organically in the moment. Some of them are not yours at all. And so Darren's trying to get the cars out of his garage that don't belong to him. And hopefully the reader will as well, unless it's a model of car that they really adore. Right. Maybe it'll be like a Tesla, and they would want to keep the Tesla.
Others in that group of four were much more committed to this idea than he was. And
right.
You could tell that he was trying to make sense of it, trying to stay connected to them, but also trying to figure out, what is this and what does it mean?
Right. You know, the first year of college, am I going to join the debate team or this club? Am I going to join the drumming troupe? And he falls in with the political activists, which no one could have warned him against. He didn't even see that coming. Yeah.
Did you know any Civil War reenactors before you wrote this book, or was that a new? How did that come up for you?
There's so many ways to answer that metaphorically that I won't do right now. I didn't know any Civil War reenactors personally, and I'd never been to any. So my tagline there, or my go-to phrase there, is that no Civil War reenactments were hurt in the writing of this novel. Mm-hmm. But in the time that I lived in the South, which was a couple of decades, I'd been around some or near some, but they just didn't feel at that time, you know, in my late teens and early 20s to be welcoming. And they may well have been. But from my perspective at the time, it didn't really seem like an activity that I would want to engage in.
So you just sort of had a fascination with pulling it into this situation and seeing what happened.
Right, right. You know, and people are, of course, having a very different and more pointed conversation about the Civil War right now in the wake of the debates around the flag and the shooting in South Carolina. But at the time, I was more so thinking about how to show the different perspectives on this event, kind of in like in the natural environment. So a lot of the debates that we hear now feel like it sounds like it's already kind of a foregone conclusion. People have decided that the flag should come down. This is what a Civil War reenactment means, and this is why it was being fought. And there are some very cogent political and moral arguments there. But when I was writing the novel, I was more so thinking about the feelings of the people who are around this community, who are not consciously every day aware of wearing a particular political cloak, but are just sort of going along with their lives and taking great pains at times to honor their traditions, to sort of like honor their elders. And so the book becomes sort of an opportunity to just sort of look at how that belief rubs against some more progressive ideas, but not, there's no condemnation, right? No. So it was more to open up, just sort of kind of open up that discussion about the different ways we read history. It's like American history is sort of like a, you know, a cruise ship, and some of us are so far below decks, it's not really been the same type of joyous trip as it's been for others. And some are so far below decks, they don't even know that the ship has docked. And so I was just maybe cutting that ship in half and just getting a look at the interplay between these various levels.
I think you make mention in the narrative that some people involved in this just see it as a states' rights issue,
right?
Whereas some people can't see it without putting it in the context of racism and the history of slavery and everything else that goes along with that.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, I'm not an essayist. I generally do not spend a lot of time writing explicit arguments, and so the book's not necessarily laying out one. The reader can walk away with the reader's own conclusion. I think what's important is really just to turn the ideas over, and there are far too many occasions where we don't, where we sort of have take a reactionary stance and just like condemn someone or praise someone, mm-hmm. you know, without thinking about the broader implications.
Your style or the voice in the book is so distinct. Maybe we could hear a small section of the book, the part where Darren is experiencing what it's like to be in the Bay Area, his first impressions.
Okay, great. Across the bay, the city convened in costume to race from bay to breakers. Happy Meal toys and plastic bags were long outlawed, and voters threatened circumcision and goldfish with the same fate. They'd once had a mayoral candidate named Jello. A roving band of rollerbladers performed the thriller zombie dance, that pop nativity, Friday nights in Union Square. And it was the UN in the airport. Yet the city thought Berserkly was weird. Duran thought it beautiful. Never mind the Nag Champa. Never mind the crusty hippies and gutter punks in greasy jackets stiff as shells lined up on Telegraph Ave, hawking tie-dye and patchouli and palming for change. On clear days, a pageantry of wind and water under sun, the bay a sea of gently wriggling silver ribbons, and the Golden Gate hovering in the distance like a mystical portal. East of the campus lazed tawny hills. On foggy days, blinding bales of cotton candy strolled the avenue's dandy, while in the distance, the tips of the bridge towers peeked through the mist like shy, gossamered nipples. The Bay Area was a beautiful woman who looked good in everything she wore.
Thank you. That was T. Geronimo Johnson reading from Welcome to Braggsville. Your opening has been described almost as a scat singing, I guess, yeah, or something like that.
Like the first sentence, right.
How did you develop that? Or what was that like for you developing that style? It's not all like that, but...
Right, yeah. Right. You know, this book is so different from my first novel, Hold It, and I knew that it had to work differently. And so, whereas Hold It had to be kind of a very intimate, almost like claustrophobic atmosphere where you're following one person very, very closely to get a sense of the emotional trajectory that and how one's emotional trajectory is affected by, say, war and a natural disaster such as Katrina, natural disaster with air quotes. But in this book, I felt like that wouldn't work. One, there's so many different viewpoints that come into play here. And also, you know, the thing is, I think it's really hard to write about race. I just think it's very hard to write about race in contemporary society. I'm not saying that writing is ever easy, but it can be easier in terms of setting to go back 15 or 20 years or to a time in the past, because we as Americans can always look back at the past and say at least we're better now, right? And I'm very much interested in writing about right now, you know, for this book. And so it felt to me at the most fundamental and instinctual level that without these different styles and voices, the story simply would not work, right? That you needed to hear these very different emotional languages. That, and then also I never want anyone to read one of my novels and feel like, oh, I read that before. It's another novel about such and such. And so that's a personal, you know, concern of mine. So those two, like what I knew this book needed to do, plus wanting it to be a kind of fresh and invigorating reading experience for my readers, meant that it would be, also I knew, a little bit more varied, like varied in tone. Yeah.
So right.
to catch the Southern Gothic, to catch the Western, to catch the academic, because within all these uses of language, there are ideologies and worldviews, right? And so moving into these languages is a way of giving sort of honor and life and space to those different ways of being in the world, and letting them have a discussion on the page with each other, as opposed to me as a narrator stepping in and saying, well, next, dear reader, et cetera, et cetera. Though I did slip in one dear reader line.
Right. Yeah, the complexity of the racial discussion within the book with the characters, like Lewis, this young Malaysian American kid who wants to be a Lenny Bruce comedian, and he has his own style, and to develop his voice and also maybe narration that sort of ping-pongs off of that or whatever,
right,
is what I think of when I hear your answer to that question about style.
Definitely, and he's in sort of engaging like in a direct battle with the university's notion of more polite uses of language and rules of discourse that are governed by you know, more conservative notions of what you should say or not say. So yeah, Lewis is kind of the anti-free speech zone person. It's like, no, you cannot tell me where I can go to express my dissent, right? If I were to obey you, then I would not actually be dissenting.
And another figure of the four people, Charlie, I mean, he seems to me to be this very sort of upstanding person.
Right.
And he has somewhat more of a formal voice.
Right. Right. Well, you know, they all have these distinctly unique backgrounds. Well, Charlie's is distinguished by the fact that he's originally from a family that has very little money, but he earns an athletic scholarship uh-huh. to a very fancy, we'll call it as Sheriff does, stay away school. And so his experience in that stay away school means that this kid who has a lot of street savvy and a lot of street smarts later shows up at college actually more academically prepared as well than his other friends. And so that, though, in combination with his family background, makes him someone who's still very like reserved and almost like pessimistic in his outlook. But he can support that with like what he's learned and what he's known. And so in some ways, he's almost trapped by his amazingly like clear-sighted view of reality at times.
Yeah. Right. He's much more clear-sighted than Darren.
Right.
About the realities of the world and what can happen.
Right, and that bumps up against his better wishes and his hopes, but his life has been so different.
Again, I'm speaking with T. Geronimo Johnson. We're talking about his book, Welcome to Braggsville. I wanted to talk for just a minute about avenues for social justice, because obviously, the avenues that these students are taking with this academic kind of trained avenue does not work well.
Right.
What are your thoughts about avenues for social justice, and what do you think can work, or do you think can work, I guess? Maybe that's not the point of your book, but it did make me want to ask that question.
I think that many different things work. There are many cars on this train. There are people who are leading Facebook movements. There are people who are doing things online with great blogs like The Root. There's the Facing Race Conference. You know, there's so many different ways to come into this conversation. And I think the key is not what works in general, but for someone to find what works for them, right? What works for you in your life? In what way can you find like time and emotional and psychological space to contribute to the world so that it will be a little bit closer to your vision of it, right? So, because we're all trying to make the world what we want it to be. And if we're not trying to do that, then by virtue of our passivity, we are in tacit agreement with things being as they are. And so I would say the key is not that we have to, you know, say, for example, be completely vegan if we don't agree with CAFOs and say, industrial agriculture. We could instead choose not to support it economically. And so it's really about just trying to live a life as conscientiously as possible. I think that's what it comes down to. You know, people perceive of change as being a change and transformation as being the province of only a special few. And it's really up to all of us every day in just so many little ways, just in conversations and smiles and decisions and where we spend our money and things like that. And also, I don't know that a failed political action is necessarily a failure if it raises awareness about an issue and gets people thinking and talking.
Is there anything that you think is important to say about Welcome to Braggsville that maybe we've neglected or missed that you think might be informative to listeners to this interview?
They should know that it has a lot of jokes in it.
Yeah.
You know, because the thing is, sometimes when I first tell people what the book is about, they'll get this look on their face. They're a little bit pained, like they want to laugh, but they don't. Like, that's preposterous, but I don't know if I can. And then I'll say, it's okay, you can laugh. It has mm-hmm. some satirical elements. And then the response will be the biggest kind of explosion of laughter, mm-hmm. you know, laughing in relief. And so, yeah, it's probably important to know that even though it takes on some very important and unfortunately more topical issues, like by the day these topics are becoming more and more widely discussed, that there is levity, that
right.
there's space to take a breath.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming into KBOO while you were in Portland, and let people know again, I have been speaking with T. Geronimo Johnson. The title of his book, now out in paperback, is Welcome to Braggsville. And I thank you so much for coming into KBOO.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for Between the Covers.
Start your Saturday morning with a little swinging country. The KBOO Swinging Country program will be broadcasting live from the Tin Shed Garden Cafe on Saturday, October 24th from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. I know you've been hankering to put a face to those velvety tones, so here's your chance. You are welcome to come early, pull up a chair, and enjoy some coffee, food, and an earful of swinging country. The Tin Shed Garden Cafe is located at 1438 Northeast Alberta Street in the City of Roses. Again, that's Swingin' Country live from the Tin Shed, Saturday, October 24th, here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight at participating Portland area restaurants. Nosh for Nonviolence is a collaborative fundraiser for two local domestic violence intervention agencies, the Portland Women's Crisis Line and West Women and Children's Shelter. Again, that's Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight. You can find the list of participating Portland area restaurants at kboo.fm. on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps, located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
The following is an encore presentation of a 2011 episode of The Film Show with Crispin Glover.
Chapter 9, in which we spend a night on the prairie. It is not our fault that we did not. Now, boys, Mr. Long will add, it's late, time for bed. Night comes, Mr. Long will dig a hole in the earth, in the center. Oh, Pa, oh, Uncle, a bear, a bear. It was on the prairie towards the thunderstorm that we would go.